My name's Paul Bestall, and you're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. The world is a possibility, if you'll only try. Welcome back to Mysteries and Monsters. This week, I'm delighted to be joined by the host of Secret Door podcast, Melissa Martell. Melissa has recently struck out on her own after co-hosting the Drawing Out the Spirits podcast over the last couple of years. Melissa's podcast focuses more on the paranormal and esoteric forces that surround us, and we cover what got her into the subject, our mutual love of spooky stories, our family's paranormal and spiritual histories, as well as some of her upcoming shows. Meanwhile, out there in the real world, it seems to be getting far weirder than it has been for quite some time. It's been a very strange week for any of us who love these topics, as the UFO Pentagon saga continues unabated, and now the FBI have released Bigfoot files. These cover the investigations the organisation covered back in the mid-70s, and it's also brought one of the pioneers of cryptozoology back into the limelight, Peter Byrne. Fortunately, we'll be speaking to Peter on a forthcoming Bigfoot special that will be coming up, hopefully in the next 3 to 4 weeks, so keep your eyes peeled for that release. In regards to Mysteries and Monsters, it's been another great week as the show continues to grow, so thank you very much for continuing to support us. Keep spreading the word and don't forget to rate and review us on whichever podcast app you use. You can find and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter and YouTube, as well as supporting us on Patreon for just $1 a month. Now, let's get spooky with Melissa Martell. My guest today is Melissa Martell, host and creator of Secret Door Podcast. Melissa has just launched her solo podcast after working on Drawing Out the Spirit Show for the last couple of years. So, Melissa, welcome to Mysteries and Monsters. We're delighted to have you today.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to be here. It's fantastic.
Oh, thank you very much. So, Secret Door Podcast, tell us all about it.
Well, brand new. I'm a graphic designer, so I used all my skill to get this started up within the past week. So brand new, one episode out. It's just an introductory episode. Basically, I'm going to be doing, you know, intimate talks on occult, paranormal, culture, and my favorite, human psychology. So it's got a little bit of a black and white sort of Victorian feel to it, black and white photography. I'm liking where it's going, but it's going to be more structured than what Drawing Out the Spirits podcast was. There's going to be like a half an hour episode where it'll just be me. And then we'll have an episode each month where I interview somebody for an hour on, like, for instance, we have a show coming out about World Dracula Day, where we have Gary Parsons coming on. I have someone coming on to talk about their film on Borley Rectory. So those will be longer, and then that will be cut up with me talking about a certain topic. Like in my intro, I talked for half an hour on folklore on the east coast of Canada, which is like a ghostly forerunner, predictor of omens kind of thing. So that's pretty much the setup of what I'm doing with Secret Door Podcast, and so I'll see how it goes. I feel really good about it. It's like more precise, and I'm, you know, controlling it the way I would have always wanted to have a podcast be.
Yeah, well, I mean, it certainly sounds interesting. Like I say, I listened to the first episode because that's only just dropped the last couple of days, and I found it really interesting because I've always, it was quite interesting. You mentioned when you were growing up, you lived in a Victorian house where you had a kind of spiritual connection inside it. And myself growing up, I grew up in a converted vicarage, which was built in the 18th century, and was about 20 yards away from the church and the graveyard.
Wow.
And it was a very interesting 5 years, I will say that.
I think when you grow up around things like older buildings and graveyards, like where I lived in New Brunswick, we had like a public park that was essentially a graveyard as well. I think when you grow up with older things like that and surroundings, you really have a different perspective and appreciation for culture.
Yeah, very true. I mean, it is quite interesting because, I mean, obviously there's a lot of theories in regards to, you know, things like the stone tape theory, where, you know, a building or a surround can kind of absorb the history and certain events over that time. And I think when you've got an old building and it feels lived in and it feels like it's historical, I think that can sometimes allow you to sort of open yourself up a bit more to the potential.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So yeah, it was very good. I mean, I've got to really sort out everything that happened there, because it's something we still talk about, myself and my mum and my brother. My brother was a little bit too young, but we still talk about how it was.
Have you done a show on it on your podcast?
No, not yet.
Oh, you should.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, I keep putting it off, but mind you, it's one of those things. I mean, that's why I'm here now, because my brother's been at me for about 3 years to do this, so we've eventually got
awesome
to where we need to get to. So what was it? Was it that kind of experience growing up, Melissa, that gave you the interest that you have in the paranormal, or was there another event, or was it something that just naturally occurred, you know, as you grow up and it's what you gravitated towards?
Well, I think it naturally occurred, but I think it comes from the fact that I was born into a family that accepted these ideas. That, you know, we had my mother's aunt, which would be my great aunt, was like a tarot card reader and is psychic. And they believed in stuff like this. And when I in that city where I grew up in and lived in that haunted Victorian house. I mean, I was told my school was haunted. You know, I'm being told the hospital I was born in is haunted. So you're just surrounded by a lot of these folk tales and folklore, and you grow up with it. Now, it's not that I went through life wandering around saying every house that I lived in was haunted. I grew up fairly normal. I never really had, after that house, a lot of experiences, but it's always there as your base. And so circumstances just happened. I mean, before I did Drawing Out the Spirits podcast, I helped found the Folklore podcast with Mark Norman. I did all the design on that. And before that, I wrote for The Curious 14 with Matt Cook. So I was doing stuff. I just met people, and it just came, after I got into graphic design, it just resurfaced in my life. And so it was always there. I always had that belief, but I also am really logical as well. Like I think you also have to be really grounded in reality, but it's been there as my base because it's the culture that I grew up in when I was really young.
Yeah. I mean, it's always quite funny as well when we think, because within a year or so I was moving, because we left there when I was seven. When we moved, my aunt used to run pubs around the UK. So she used to go in some really old buildings, and they were living in a town called Chester.
Oh yeah, I had a teacher that taught me in high school Western Civilization that was from Chester.
Ah, I mean, absolutely, and there's a city, you know, that's steeped in Roman history. I mean,
yes.
It's one of the oldest towns and cities in England. So, and they ended up with a poltergeist called Fred. And we found it quite amusing. It was almost as if the family had a year off and then it just turned up somewhere else.
Wow. Like you mean it moved?
Well, we're not sure, because it never made any sense, but it was more obviously because I absolutely adore Poltergeist. It's my big thing. And I'm currently doing some work on towards completing a book about them. It just seemed quite peculiar, because my aunt's family had a teenage daughter at the time. And obviously the vast majority of poltergeist cases tend to sort of gravitate towards a teenager, mostly girls rather than boys. But The family just found it quite amusing that essentially we'd had one haunting at one place for 5 years, and then, you know, the other side of the country, another one started for another side of the family, which, and nobody else in the family's ever had anything else like this. It's just sort of my side of the family and my aunt's side. Mm-hmm. So it might have been paranormal tennis. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think that families have a collective, like you have a collective consciousness where things and beliefs get stored. And I think families have a collective of their own. And originally I was saying, oh, we should talk about sleep paralysis and shadow people. I think that certain family members, when there's times of stress in my family, used to see things like shadow figures. And I think it's a projection. I think a family has a collective. I think it can come out. I think things can happen. And I'm not sure exactly how it works, but I think families certainly have a collective consciousness that affects things.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, my family is very much of the same kind of ilk. You know, my grandmother was a white witch who used to do tarot readings and crystal balls and tea leaves for numerous people. And people would come from miles around. And as a child, I had at the time I didn't realise it, but obviously looking back, I had the honour of meeting Doris Stokes, who was probably the most famous psychic in probably the world in the 70s.
Okay.
And I just thought she was just this friendly old lady that used to come and visit me gran. No idea who she was till I was about 20, and obviously she'd passed away by then. But it was that kind of thing that, it kind of jumped a generation, because my mum's quite into the paranormal and things, and so is my brother, but probably not to the extent that I am, or I've sort of embraced it. So and it's always been kind of, our family's had that kind of split between quite balanced about situations, which we all are. Mm-hmm. We're not sort of it must be a haunting, you know. We tend to try and look at every opportunity.
What's the explanation first? Like, there could be a rational explanation, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've always, you know, like I say, when you live in an old building, they make noises that, you know, you can feel it settling and things. But there were a couple of things that, you know, clearly couldn't be anything like that.
Yeah.
As Sir Arthur Conan Doyle says in Sherlock Holmes, you know, once you've removed every other possibility, what you're left with has to be the explanation, regardless of how daft or illogical it may seem, I think, sometimes, Melissa.
Yeah, no, for sure. Absolutely. And I know that when you're surrounded by people who believe in this culture, it's really actually rather normal for you. And I think, like, for me, when I went to school, I realized that, because I was born on the East Coast, but I moved out west. And I think I realized that the west of Canada was a lot different than the east of Canada. So I realized quite quickly when I was 7, 8, 9 that nobody else really quite believed in these things out in the west. So I was, that's probably when you kind of shut it off.
Would you say that's because what would be the cultural reason for that? Is it because they're quite a newer population compared to obviously the East Coast being colonized first?
The East Coast is colonized first. The East Coast has a lot of immigrants from Scotland, Ireland, and early England. The West, when you're going out to Alberta or to British Columbia, British Columbia had a high amount of Scottish and English immigrants and people who came from England who were well off, who settled in places like Victoria. That's true. So they have their ghost heritage, but I think it's just more modern technology and it's just the culture doesn't get spread as much. And I think it has to do with modernization. They're more like, there's no people telling tales around fires and they're just more watching TV and in with popular culture. And that's just how people have grown up. They didn't grow up with the same base that I had. And they were more like, I didn't have cable TV till I was 14. I never ever watched TV when I was young, but most of my friends had TV all the time. So they had a totally different base. Maybe they were, more affected by modernization. And, but I still think there's a need for it. I still think there's a need for it in every culture. That's why people like to watch horror films and such. But I think modernization, they're more likely to say, yeah, that's not true though.
Yeah, very true. I mean, it is one of those things, because regardless of how we view the paranormal, it is essentially a modern version of folklore, regardless. You know, it's just taken on a different approach to the older tales of things like hobbits and dragons and fairies and the fae folk. It's kind of become a more encapsulating subject, I think, these days.
Yeah, and I think, well, I think there's probably two different veins to it. Like, you could probably go and look at it in a folkloric way. A lot of things are probably based on folklores, tales and stuff. But there's also a scientific approach to it as well. Like with poltergeists, like you said, there is like the what is it? Is it SPR? They do tons of studies
yes.
that are very scientific towards poltergeists. Matt Cook, who TFC, he's very interested in poltergeists as well. He does a lot of studies working with SPR and was doing studies in Poland. You know, he's said a lot. He's like, you know, there's a lot of science to this. It's not all just folklore and fairy tales either.
Yeah, I think there is a lot that for me, I'm there clearly has, there's some kind of reaction going on for poltergeist, that it, be it you know, based on brainwaves or stress or personal circumstances or difficulties. There seems to be some kind of hot pot that occasionally you get the right recipe and all hell breaks loose.
Yeah, that was kind of what I was going for with the Secret Door podcast. I mean, it wouldn't matter if you were writing a book or you're doing a play or whatever you're coming on about. It's like there's a whole bunch of different circumstances that come together to create this event. If you're writing a book or you've had a paranormal event, like I've never re-experienced a massive haunted house ever again. So I'm like, and the people, like I said in my first podcast, that live in that house now, they haven't experienced any paranormal stuff. So I can only fathom that it was a unique circumstance at that time with the people who were living there. I mean, we don't know, maybe emotional issues spice that up, and maybe there was people who were living in that house that were helping keep it alive. It could be a talpa. I mean, we have no idea. I mean, we know what we experienced and recorded it down, but we also, I mean, no one's experiencing it anymore. So
yeah, there's a direct parallel there with what happened with us, because there's never been anything reported since we left that house at all. Nothing.
Yeah.
And it's strangely enough, it's now been converted into a couple of houses and a graphic design studio. And there is nothing about it as far as the village is where it is. It's not a haunted house, not thought about at all. But like you say, it may be just that the right people at the right time, I wouldn't necessarily say it causes the right reaction. It depends on how you take to it. But yeah, there's definitely something there, I think.
Yeah, and it's important also to look at human psychology in connection with paranormal experience, because I believe I don't think it necessarily means that people are crazy or that their poor psychology is causing it, but I think that the state of mind you're in and brain waves that are operating at the time can cause you to have different experiences or see perhaps things that have happened there before or actually trigger the paranormal experiences, or you could be projecting. It can happen.
Absolutely, yeah, very much so. So, going forwards with the Secret Door, this is clearly you're kind of going to investigate certain avenues. So, what kind of subjects are you really looking forward to getting stuck into? I mean, what kind of fires up your imagination when it comes to this kind of situation?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to be super picky. I invite anyone to come on the show, but I'm not really looking at like UFO or Bigfoot or cryptozoology. I'm more looking at human psychology. I also like to talk to people about occult practices. So I have someone who wants to come on about his book on chaos magic, looking at people's different belief systems and experiences to do with the occult and paranormal and how that interacts in culture. So, and you know, the name Secret Door Podcast, I can kind of keep it wide open. I don't have to just do one thing. You know, you can sort of go in different avenues. And if something's popular in culture, it allows me to go and see if I want to navigate there. Because, I mean, you never know. Vampires go in and out and ghosts go in and out of pop culture. culture. So it leaves it a little bit more open than a title like Drawing Out the Spirits. So I want to have the talks on a lot to do with the occult and how human psychology interacts with the occult and paranormal.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fabulous name for a podcast because it's enticing because, you know, when you talk about this subject, there are a myriad of avenues you can go down. You know, the paranormal is not just a one size fits all, Melissa. You can take it wherever you wish to go and focus on a particular type of haunting or experience or religious cultural impact. Like you say, there are so many strands to the one overriding title that I think it just gives you a whole range of opportunities to indulge whatever takes your fancy, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know people might be looking at like Secret Door, but it's a good name. You know, it's an image that people can like, oh, a door, oh, a secret, oh, opening a door. There's a lot of different things that automatically trigger in a majority of people. So it visually, as an icon, a door reaches a wider audience than, say, our old logo and Drawing Out the Spirits was Vinegar Tom. Most people are like, what's that on your logo? A lot of people don't actually know what Vinegar Tom, they have no clue what that is, but they know what a door is.
So,
I should hope so. They know what a door is, but they're like, what the hell is that thing? Excuse my language. What's that thing on your the logo? Like a lot of people ask me, and I had to explain what Vinegar Tom was in terms of witchcraft and Matthew Hopkins. And they were like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
I thought, you know what, this reaches, people can get this. Like you're the secret door, you're sort of opening a door and delving into more intimate talks on human psychology, occult practices, paranormal. This is the basic.
Yeah. Fantastic. So in regards to what you know, your first episode, like I say, you were talking about what you called over there, which is a term I'm not very familiar with, I'll be brutally honest, which was forerunners. So what was it that kind of, I mean, obviously there are a variety of these things, and I don't want to start going off on a tangent so soon. So obviously the couple of stories, strangely enough, one of the stories you mentioned about the family who saw the light in the sky.
Yeah,
I'd read that last week.
Really?
Thought, and I thought that's a bit funny. Odd because I was. That's even weirder because the next thing I read ended up taking me to an article about a Twilight Zone episode. So that's even weirder. But
I'm psychic.
Something strange going on. But it was really interesting because in regards to that, I've always been really interested in. A collection of stories I heard as a very young child, I must have been 8 or 9, on a show in the UK called Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious World. And one of those was about premonitions and crisis ghosts, which is what a lot of people use for when you see the ghost of someone who's died, but you're not aware of it. And they had a wonderful interview with a lady called Eva Hart, who was in when she was interviewed, she was 7 when the Titanic sank. So she'd have been 78.
Right.
And she has told this story for years that, they were really excited. Her mum, her dad and her, they had agreed to emigrate to the States and they were going across on the Titanic. And as soon as her father booked the ticket, her mother was overcome with a overriding sense of dread. She couldn't shake it at all. To the point that he said, right, the dad said, if that's how you feel, either you and the daughter stay here or we'll all cancel it and we'll get on the next one. And eventually she felt, obviously kind of shamed into it, said no, we'll do it. But Eva always says that from the day they set off, her mum refused to go to bed. Every night she would stay up wearing 3 coats, 3 sets of undergarments, tight leather shoes, gloves and a hat every night. And then obviously one particular night they were still up. And obviously they heard, she said, all you felt was like a wobble on the in the cabin. Just a wobble. Nothing. Didn't hear a crash, a bang, screaming, nothing. And
wow.
About 20 minutes later, a father came running in. And a mother looked at her father and he just said, "You'd best get on deck."
Wow.
So they did all that. And she's absolutely convinced. She says, "The only reason I'm alive is because of my mum." Now, her father died on the Titanic.
On the Titanic.
Both her and her mum survived because obviously it was women and children first, as everybody famously
yeah,
knows.
Yeah, that's horrible.
But that's one of the strangest stories. And like I said, I saw that story 30, 35 years ago. And it stayed with me my entire life because she was absolutely 100%, you know, she was unshakable in her belief that if it wasn't for her mum's premonition, she wouldn't have survived. None of them would have survived.
Yeah.
So it's something that's always intrigued me.
Her mum had like a psychic premonition?
Well, she didn't know what was going to happen. She just knew something bad. Yeah, she just knew something bad was going to happen, and she just wanted to be prepared because, you know.
Yeah.
And it's odd as well because it wasn't like it happened quite a lot. I mean, if you look about, there aren't many ships that had gone down like that. So it wasn't like, oh, it happens quite a lot or it was a risk or something. It's just very odd that, you know, and there's quite a large body of these stories. I've seen about 20 different stories from different people who all had very similar portents or feelings about the situation that they didn't know what was going to happen, but they knew it had a negative connotation.
Yeah, they felt it in their bones almost that something bad was, like, there was just not something right about the situation. I think, I think there's, I don't know if everything's already set to happen. Yeah. And that's a cue to, like, hey, you're not meant to do this, so avoid it. I'm not sure. But, like, in the case of Forerunner, it's a very East Coast term, and it's actually a spirit that shows up to warn you. So I know you have it there, and that's probably in a lot of different cultures. Like, the Banshee could be called a Forerunner. I think the term Forerunner was coined by a very famous folklorist in East Coast Canada, Helen Crichton, and she was in the early, she was born in 1899 or something like that. So she was collecting a lot of folk songs and traditional songs early on and going throughout all of the East Coast, especially in Nova Scotia. And I think she had this, what was that song called? Oh, I think it's actually, its origins is a Scottish song. It was like Hail to Nova Scotia or something. And I think they thought it was a Canadian Nova Scotian song, but I think when you trail it down, it might actually go to Scotland.
Yeah.
Scottish tune, I'm not going to sing it for you. I'm not going to scare yeah, so she's the one, I think, who coined that term, Forerunner. And it's basically the same thing as, like, I don't know, you'd see in Macbeth, a ghost coming to tell you of bad things or whatever. Like, I think this has been, it's been used in literature.
Yeah.
You could, black dog could be a forerunner. You could have a cat be a forerunner and show up, and every time this figure shows up, it, you know, something bad happens to the family. In the case of the one tale that I tell in the podcast, it was her own father showed up. And she didn't see it. I think she heard it, but her aunt had seen it. And then when they went to the door, after they heard him by the door, he wasn't there. And he was actually in another part of the city. And he ended up a couple days later, in an accident. So, I don't think it's necessarily, they get the feeling that something bad's going to happen, but only because some sort of paranormal event happens or some ghostly figure shows up and then disappears. It's like really disturbing. So I don't know if they're the same and it's just projected differently as like feeling something bad's going to happen. I'm not sure.
I mean, yeah, I mean, but it's like you referred to there. I mean, it is a staple of literature going back centuries because, I mean, you know, the most famous literary version of the story is A Christmas Carol.
Yeah.
Which has a variety of connotations that, you know, it's about second chances. It's about the spirit of Christmas. It's about charity. It's about the state of the country at the time, poverty. But it's also that, you know, the main tenement of that story is that, that Ebenezer Scrooge is visited by four spirits who all give him predictions on how his actions have affected his life and how his reaction can change his life.
Yeah, it's a warning of what's going to visit him. And I think those kind of stories, they have a bigger... They're meant to be told for everybody to have a bigger message for all of society. Mm. So that those seem more like I kind of differentiated between that. Like the second story that I told in my podcast, you know, the one about the light in the sky the being and the being had their child and then the being with their child disappeared and they went into the house and then they found the child dead and there was a cat on the child's face sort of smothering them. I think those kind of stories, and same with Ebenezer Scrooge, they're meant to tell a larger group of people like a warning, like it's something based in reality, like don't let your cat on your baby's face, they'll smother them. Yes. Don't do this because this. And they're really different from the one that I had from the first lady. That was a more intimate... It's almost like her father's spirit left his body, showed up, and they knew. Mm. So it wasn't giving them like an ethical tale or you got to smarten up and do your life right. It was like, you can't avoid this. This is going to happen. I'm going to be leaving soon. So it was a little bit different. There were two very different tales. And I was trying to decipher that out when I was just talking live on the podcast. But I think they're all premonitions, but one is like a bigger story. Mm. For people that's based in a reality, an experience that you're going to realistically have. And the other one is actually possibly someone's spirit or something telling you, I'm about to leave. Mm. That's the differentiation that I got out of it.
Yeah. I mean, there are tons of examples of people being visited by, you know, dying relatives or people they care about a great deal. They have, you know, they may not have seen them for quite a long time. And it's interesting, like you say there, why do some people have a visual response, whereas others get a feeling, others get a smell, an aroma that sometimes precedes. So it's very interesting, like you say, even on a psychological level, why do certain people have very different experiences, which are essentially all of the same nature?
Yeah, I'm wondering if different parts of their brains are being stimulated, therefore they have this experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could trigger somebody to smell bee in their kitchen from 30 years ago, and they're visually experiencing it, or you could stimulate their brain in a different way, and they could just smell burnt toast.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, smell is a strange thing, because very often there will be certain times where anybody will pick up a certain smell or aroma or scent that they perhaps haven't smelt for years, and it will instantly take you back to that moment.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very powerful sense, smell, and it I think when you look at things of the paranormal, it's probably something that I think really could do with more kind of scrutiny, because there are quite a lot of stories where people, you know, suggest that they, you know, smell things. And obviously I was speaking, I've spoken to a couple of people in regards to aliens and UFOs, and there's you know, stories of certain aromas and smelling things differently and stuff like that. So I think it's peculiar, because you know, it's probably not something you would expect to be the main sense that realizes that something strange is going on.
Well, yeah, and especially if it's like a gross smell. Like, I know people who have smelled rotting flesh in their house, and it's in one space and it just disappears, and they can't find any source of it. And it's like, that's concerning when you have a rotting smell. It's a little less concerning if you're just smelling a rose scented perfume.
Mm. Yeah, it's certainly more preferable. I would definitely agree there.
But I think it's our instinct to like, if you smell something rotting, like there's something negative, there's something going on, there's death, there's something like that. And so it's perhaps using that to communicate it's one of the ways to communicate with us. Whereas if it's a rose scented or like, I don't know, pineapple, it's more positive. So it's communicating the whatever's here is positive. It's okay. Unless it's trying to trick us and confuse us. But we had that in one house. The lady on the West Coast, the lady who had we bought it from, she had cancer. She had cancer and she passed away after we had bought the house from her, probably about a year later. And we constantly, after she passed, we constantly would, when you would walk into the room that was her, there was one space. It was rotty, gross smell. And it would come and go, and it drove us insane. I mean, we had renovated the whole house. It was all new, and nobody could figure it out. It was the only weird thing about that house is there was, like, this rotting body smell every once in a while. And I had one friend visit me there who said she saw a woman standing in the door that disappeared. But no, none of us had had that experience, so I can't say if that's real, but she did. But as soon as that lady had died, we constantly smelled this rotting, like, chicken kind of smell. And it would come and go. So I don't know. Was it her? I'm pretty sure we didn't leave rotting chicken anywhere for 20 years in the house, however long we lived there. But it was really strange, and it happened after her passing.
Yeah, and it's a very localized thing as well, isn't it? Because like you say, was it just in the one room as well then, Melissa?
Yeah, it was in the room she would have been in while she would have been sleeping in that room while she had cancer. It was in her bedroom as you would walk to the ensuite bathroom in this one little area. And it would come and go. And my stepfather, it drove him insane because he was like, what? That smell. He was really a neurotic guy from Germany, and it would drive him insane. He was the type, he would get down on the grass with a paintbrush and paint the weeds to make sure they were dead. So it drove him mad whenever he would smell this smell. And I was just like, it's probably, I just joke. I'm like, it's probably the old lady that lived here. Just ignore it.
She's just passing through. Give her a minute. She'll be gone.
She's passing through. Exactly.
Oh dearie. I mean, it's quite funny that kind of thing, because it is very unusual. But then again, you know, like we've just been saying about different senses, your friend saw something. Did she say she'd smelt anything?
No, she just, we were having my mom was having like a Tupperware party and invited her. So we went there. It was a really stormy night too. None of us had ever had any paranormal real experiences at my mother's house, just the smell for the most part. And maybe some sleep paralysis stuff, but that can happen. That's happened to me anywhere. So we were sitting there at this Tupperware party, which was boring to me, but I was supporting my mom. And she looked up, and she was just staring in the doorway. And I looked over. I was like, what are you staring at? And she said, she's like this. And she described this lady that was standing in the doorway. And she's like, she's standing there, and now she's gone. And I'm like, well, that sounds like the lady who used to live here. And I'm just like, I don't know if she was seeing some kind of imprint from the past. That could be, or was she there? I have a feeling she was seeing some sort of memory. I don't know for sure though, but she, and interestingly enough, it was a very stormy West Coast stormy night, like almost hurricane level winds. So that was interesting.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like you say there, you mentioned sleep paralysis. I've only had it happen once. But it was absolutely terrifying at the time. I mean, obviously, looking back, I understand perfectly where it was. But at the time, the event itself was rather quick. 5 minutes, I think, and the situation was done and dusted. And you, the whole way you feel and everything changed. What do you think in regards to... Because mine was just simply an oppressive feeling, and it felt like I was suffocating. And I was awake, but I couldn't move. It felt like something was sitting on my chest. But, that, you know, that kind of leads you back to tales of succubuses and incubuses and that kind of sense that people claim to have in that kind of situation. So is it something that you've experienced yourself, Melissa?
I have. I've experienced it really subtly, where I just felt like something was tickling my leg and I couldn't move, and then I woke up. But I've had it extensively where I've been sleeping in bed and I knew something was coming. It was coming in the door. It was walking down the hallway and I could feel it was coming closer, and it came into my room and I couldn't move, and it crawled over on top of me, and I was like, no. Like, I was like, that's my personality. I'm an Aries. I was like, no, get out of here. And it was like, and it responded like this hissing yes. And I was like, oh, and I just, you know what? I let go. I was like, don't try to fight it. Just let go. And it sort of started to dissolve because it was right on top of me. And this minute I stopped trying to freak out and be afraid, and I just sort of relaxed it, and I was able to wake up. The more you struggle, it seemed to me, the more it actually builds. It was a really strange thing. But it's almost like you have to recognize, it's almost like lucid dreaming. You have to recognize that, okay, I have some control. I'm just gonna let go, because it seems like the more you struggle, the more it pushes back. So I can't help but think that it's a projection or it's something psychological. Although there is multi, I've seen stories where people, I know it's something psychological, almost in depth, because I've seen stories where this one girl, she had a hectic childhood. She had an eating disorder, and this hag, she had the old hag show up in her eating disorder, and she suffered with it her whole life. It messed up her sleeping, and I mean, she was almost at death's door, and then she got pregnant, and her pregnancy is why she stopped starving herself eventually. But in the show, there's actually, it was a show on called Ghostly Encounters. She suffered with this for years, and they did what they called an intervention for her. They took her on a shamanic thing, and she described it as like they were pulling something out of her. So, and then she was able to sleep, and it actually, from what I know from her update, that she was able to sleep and it wasn't visiting her anymore. But the night before, the shamanic ritual, it was the worst she'd ever experienced it. I can't help but think it's something psychological or some negative experiences. You formed some sort of thing and you're projecting it out, and you have some sort of negative. It could be collective from your family and abuse. It could be stress. She had it severe, so I think it was probably more abuse and stress. You could just be going through an extremely stressful time in your life. Maybe you were in a country where you were in a war, and this is how your psyche is sort of projecting it out. And I really think it's psychological, and it's a projection. And I don't, that doesn't mean I don't think it's real. I think it's actually very real. But just because your mind's projecting and creating it doesn't mean I don't think it actually creates its own energy and comes at you. I think it is very real. If it wasn't, people wouldn't be suffering so much from it. But when she said that, like, she did this shamanic thing, sometimes that kind of power of, and it felt like they were pulling a part of her out. I think it's true. I think they were sort of trying to dissipate an abused part of her that was attacking herself. That's just my personal opinion on it.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting, like you say, because there are a variety of experiences for people that have sleep paralysis. Like you say, you had quite, you had a vocalization or a feeling of vocalization in yours. I mean, for me, it was just an overwhelming, suffocating feeling that eventually lifted. But I've read, as you refer to there, countless stories of people that have seen hags or shadow people. I mean, even alien abduction. There are people that, when they've had sleep paralysis situations,
Very similar.
very similar kind of feeling. Like I say, the older stories tended to focus on things like incubuses and succubuses, demons coming to people at night when they were weak, those type of things. So it is interesting that it essentially is the same phenomenon, but the reactions of the participants seem to be wildly different.
And I think the reaction, I think the reason, the more intense it is, the more trauma or the more stress, you're dealing with something really stressful, the more intense that it is. And like there's, I don't doubt that it could be so intense that you could probably have a heart attack and die in your sleep, that it would be so real, especially if, say, you're somebody who comes from a war-torn country, and you now have found peace. You've left, and you're in peaceful times. It's like PTSD times a million, projecting in your sleep. I think it's the way that the mind deals with all this trauma. And it's I don't fully, and I'm not going to pretend to fully understand it, but it's definitely linked to the psychology and trauma that people are going through, or stress. Because every time that happens to me, any kind of sleep paralysis or a shadow figure standing over me, it's always when I'm going through an emotionally stressful time. Like, always.
I mean, it may be a rather extreme way of the brain kind of giving you a kick, or making you focus on something, or some kind of stress relief. That it's some kind of I don't know, physical manifestation of the actual feeling that gives you something to kind of fight against. But it is peculiar, like you say, in regards to like you shadow people, especially with you know the kind of people hanging around doorways, or it's always in the corner of your eye, or you know dancing past a doorway. There's always something like that seems to occur as well, doesn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I've woken up and I've seen a shadow figure standing in the doorway, and I was like, I can, if I think it seriously, I can be a very confrontational person. So I was very confrontational. Basically, I said, you're not welcome here. You're not invited. And it did leave. But I think the shadow thing has visited different people in my family. That's why I say, I think there's a family collective. And I mean, who knows? I could be wrong. You could, because you are having emotional problems and psychological, emotional stress, it could open you up and there could really be dark things that come and visit you, and it's they're able to because they're taking an advantage because you're weaker emotionally at that time. I mean, it could be that too. I could be like, but there's definitely something linked to your emotions being incapacitated. Like I said, it could be a projection, it could be, but it also could be just that you're weakened at that time and you're open to things that can come in and affect you and attack you and suck your energy some more.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, you know, as I'm about to refer to that, it does always seem there is always throughout history there has always been a feeling that if people are weak, either through stress or a situation, or they feel like they're just constantly having bad luck and they're being broken down, that people can be susceptible to such entities or hauntings. In that regard, it's almost as if bad luck breeds bad luck.
Well, it's almost, and the other thing too is if your boundaries are broken down emotionally, you might be not as grounded in reality as well. And it's like a beacon, like, oh, there's that person, they're easy, I can feed off of them, get a little stronger, and then keep going. I mean, humans do that to other humans. I mean, if you're a weaker person, you might, a narcissistic person might, you know, target you to use you for something. And I don't see why it wouldn't be different with if there is such things as different energies. I don't see why anything couldn't be parasitic like that.
Well, absolutely. And like you refer to it, it is unfortunately one of humanity's worst traits.
Yes. And I mean, you have to, I think the key thing there too is emotional problems and fear. And being, like you said, being broken, like having your faculties being broken down and your boundaries are really not strong.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. I mean, and I think it just changes the way you think about things, because when you get into that, and I'm sure most people have felt like, you know, whether it's a day or a week or they just have a period of time where nothing goes right for them in either personally or professionally. And it sometimes, you know, that stress can just kind of magnify perhaps those emotions into a more tangible form. I mean, is that obviously with your kind of background and interest in psychology, how do you view that kind of response?
That to manifest a certain form. I think it's a really good, excuse me, sorry, my throat just got a little dry there. I think it's a likely, it's a likely situation. Like it's a likely scenario that you're projecting. I think that's the most likely that you're projecting certain things. And, I mean, as humans, I mean, people with personality disorders they all come usually from trauma and traumatic backgrounds, even narcissists. They come from dysfunctional families and they prey on each other and they don't have healthy boundaries. They've never been taught it in their families. So they prey at each other. So it could just be that you're projecting things out as a way to unload stress, to unload, something. It could be like the process of dreaming could even be that, like, because people are having this sleep paralysis while they're dreaming, and it's more like a nightmare. It's your subconscious saying, hey, there's a problem, hey, there's a problem, and it has to say it loud and clear because the trauma's extreme, and it's could be your mind's way of trying to process all the stress and crazy stuff you absorb. I think we are absorbing things daily that we're not even aware of because the unconscious. And I it could also be like psychologically your way of processing and trying to get it out and get it off of you so that you can function. And if the daily stress is too much, and like say you have a stressful day and you're able to process it through your dreams, and then you keep having a good week and everything's fine, you could go on and be fine and it never happens again. But if every single day is horrible trauma and every single day is bad, you don't give yourself time to heal and sort of recover from that. You just, I don't think you can ever process it enough. So if you're starving yourself every day, like that girl with an eating disorder, and you're in on the streets hanging around drug addicts, you're constantly in this like fight or flight mode and stress. There's never any time to heal or recover. You can't process. Your dreams can't process things and project it and get rid of it, because there's always more. There's always more. There's always more.
Yeah, very true. Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, it's one of those things. I mean, I remember the first time I ever saw someone suffer from night terrors on a documentary, and that was absolutely terrifying. You know, because for me, I think there's a correlation from sleep paralysis to night terror, because it just seems like a more it's a terrifying thing. And if you've never seen it, I mean, I wouldn't say I recommend going watching it, but you've certainly got to see it to believe it, because it, some of the people I've seen over the years, it seems like they're fighting for their lives in some situations. It's awful to see.
Yeah. And I think the more stressful and extreme your waking life is, the more sleep paralysis and the hag and those kind of night things there, that, I mean, it's sleep paralysis on times 50. Like, it's the same thing, but it's just the same thing. A nightmare is a dream, but a nightmare is extreme because it's trying to warn you of something extreme maybe in your daily living life. Well, these extreme cases of hag and shadow people and night terrors are connected to sleep paralysis, but it's an extreme version of it because they're dealing with something extreme. And I mean, we don't know that individual. That individual could have a perception where they're weak and they have no control in life, and therefore it's able, like, I think that might come into play, how extreme it is as well. Like, some of my worst nightmares and stuff was when I was married, when I felt totally I had no control over anything. And it literally dissipated as soon as I divorced and had more control over where things were going, and I didn't have to put up with, you know, a bad situation. So sometimes when we feel we're not in control as well, that can heighten it up, because whatever is going on can show up in your dreams, and you feel, if you feel you have no control, you're probably not going to have any control over that as well.
Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it is interesting, because I think a lot of people don't realize that, you know, that for a lot of people, sleep is the way that the mind and brain repairs itself and processes what's gone on, regardless of whether you dream of it or not, or you're one of those people who's a regular dreamer, or some people that don't even seem to remember any dreams. But it does seem like there's like a sliding scale, and there are a lot of conditions that can magnify certain things, like you say. And I think with you saying all about personal stress, be it in professional, personal, whatever, these things are kind of it's like lighting the touch paper to certain aspects in the mind, I think.
Yes. And I mean, there's certain stresses we have control over. And so people need to realize for themselves, like, there's certain things you do, you have control over certain things, like how you perceive at work. And you do have control over certain things, but there are elements you have no control over. If you're living in a war-torn country, you don't have control of that. If you're a child and you're in a family that's abusive, you don't have control over a lot of things. But I mean, and as you get older, I mean, there's certain things you do have control over, of who you hang around with, actions you take. And I think people just, it probably helped to realize that you have control. There's focus on the things you have control over, and sort of, I tend to, okay, I don't have control over that, I'm going to focus on what I have control over. I don't have control over what other people say about me, but I have control over my actions and how I work and what I do, and the people who know me will know that I'm reliable, thus forth. And so I have control over that, and other people who see differently, well, to heck with them. And I think it's the same, like, with dreaming or anything. Is like, okay, there's small, maybe focus on the micro things that you have control over every day, and it might actually help alleviate and make you have a better boundary in your dreams. It's just a technique that I've done over time is just try to focus on what I do have control over to help me feel like I have control overall, but I don't have to control everything.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Sometimes you just got to let things slide, and what will be will be.
Yeah, it's like you're just like, I can't do anything about that. I'm going to go focus on the fact that I can get my house clean and my dishes done right now. Whatever it is, right? Whatever it is.
Absolutely. So where do you feel this kind of, you know, the forerunner and the like, where do you, I mean, I found it quite interesting when they look at how folklore adapts and changes. And to my shame, I don't know enough about Canadian mythology and folklore. It's something I need to get more in, up to date with. So what's the kind of things that you've kind of come across that seem to be quite uniquely Canadian in regards to that kind of situation?
I would say that there's, I don't know tons about specific Canadian folklores, but I would say things like the Wendigo. There's going to be a lot of native folklores that you're going to tie into Canadian folklores. There's some local folklores on Vancouver Island where I am, and they're all tied into native traditions about burials and people. They like here in Vancouver Island where I live in, they had what's called sky burials. So there's a whole bunch of folklores tied into things. There's folklores about the mountains. There's folklores big time here about Sasquatch, which I'm not really into. there's folklores about it. And then there's people who swear they really exist and they go out, and that's fair enough. That's fine. A lot East Coast of Canada, the folklore there, you're going to find that it ties heavily into the United Kingdom or what would be England, Ireland, Scotland, because that's where the immigrants that first came from that settled in the East Coast. So they're going to have a lot of similar things. They're going to have the black dog. They're going to have like the forerunner was something that Helen Crichton, but it's a ghostly figure. But they also have, in Newfoundland, the province, they have, this ties back into actually sleep paralysis, they have the old hag folklore. And in fact, there was a whole entire town that was affected by the old hag and sleep paralysis. So that's there. And you see that in like St. Hag, what was it? Hag of the Dribble or something like that you have in England. There was some kind of, they have the same thing. You have the black dog, the hag, headless horsemen, ghostly coaches. There's all those sort of, and I think you're going to find that on the East Coast. Whereas out here on the West Coast, there's a lot of native folklore. It's very different. And I don't know a lot of the native folklore, not off the top of my head. I've read about it, but it's really hard for me to recall. But Sasquatch probably, maybe not in the form that we know it now, but there's probably some sort of hairy man of the woods sort of thing that the natives probably believe in. But there's a lot of things with the Wendigo and different little demons that they actually have. And I'm not sure what is specific, but I'm going to think that, yeah, the West Coast would have that more than the East Coast.
Yeah. I mean, the Black Shuck thing is, or the Black Dog. I mean, over here, we've got about 14 different versions of it. It depends where you live in the country, because where I live in Yorkshire, it's known as a bar guest.
Oh, I've never heard that one before.
Yeah, but they're all similar descriptions. They're all large dogs around the size of a calf, flaming red eyes, dribbling jaws, often found harassing lonely travellers at night. So that alone, even in England, shows you the difference, because there are up north, it's seen as a more benevolent spirit. There are lots of stories in the north of England about how the Shuck is a guide or a protector.
Right. Okay.
Whereas down south, and so, you know, Cornwall and Devon and East Anglia, it's more of a demonic creature that foretells death or bad luck or other such unfortunate incidents for whoever witnesses it.
Interesting. I wonder how that divide happened.
Yeah,
because
there doesn't seem to be any real, because obviously England as a country, you know, we've all been invaded at the same time. So we, you know, we had the Romans, then the Anglo-Saxons, and then we had the Vikings. So other than that, you know, for a, over a, and then we had the Normans, obviously. Other than that, you know, for 1,000 years, nobody else has come. So it is quite weird that that there is a cultural split of the same legend in such a small, you know, because we're not the biggest country in the world, but to have such a wide variety of responses to the same kind of legend is quite peculiar.
Yeah, it would be that would be interesting to know the difference between northern beliefs and like from long ago and then people southern, like perhaps maybe did the Romans, did they go right up to the north, or did they mainly occupy the south of England?
No, all the way.
They went all the way, yeah.
Yeah, they built Hadrian's Wall to keep the nasty Scots out. So that's the very top of England. So obviously York was one of their main settlements, and there's a very famous hundreds of stories of people seeing legionnaires in York. Hundreds.
Wow.
And obviously they got, as we mentioned earlier, Chester was another big place. So, they, you know, they went all over the country, and same with the obviously the Normans and the Vikings. It's very odd.
I'm just going to assume there must be some sort of tribal thing going on.
That wouldn't surprise. Yeah, it's peculiar, but for that. So going forwards then, the podcast just launched. So where can everybody find it? How do they follow you? And what's going to be happening next for you, Melissa?
Okay. So it's pretty simple. Go to secretdoorpodcast.com. So on there, you'll find everything you need to. You'll find social media links. I'm on Facebook and Instagram. So we have a Facebook page and a Facebook group, Secret Door Podcast. But you can find the Facebook page on the website. Right now, the podcast is waiting to be approved on the new RSS feed on iTunes, but it's up on Google Play, Stitcher, and YouTube, and other things. So once it's approved, probably in the next week or so, you'll see the podcast up on iTunes and whatever else is. There's a multitude of different podcasts affiliated with iTunes, so it should be there within the next week. So it's going to be available on all those platforms to download. So the first episode, of course, was just a little mini introduction. I didn't get into anything on specifics about the haunted house I lived in. That might be another time. So we're going to be having Gary Parsons come on. We're going to do a World Dracula Day episode that's going to be out on May 25th. I've got Ashley Thorpe coming on. We're talking about Borley Rectory and a film, amazing film that he's done on Borley Rectory. We're going to have an episode on Jack the Ripper too. I'm talking to Andrew D. Gable about that. And I've got some people coming on about their magic and occult practices. I might have some different my brain just went blank. I hate that when that happens. The word is poltergeist. People talking about the research on poltergeist, and I don't know. You can come on one time too if you want, Paul.
Hey, I'd be honoured. It'd be lovely. Yeah, I could talk poltergeist all night, I'm afraid.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, so there's a really big theme in the first part of it, and it's very Victorian Dracula.
Yep.
Early Rectory, Jack the Ripper. So we'll just go with that. But like I said, I'm going to do a guest episode and then a smaller episode with myself, sort of split up into different energies, see how that works.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would say by May 25th, it'll be full running on all the different platforms when the World Dracula one comes out. And just to let you know, Gary Parsons, who's going to be on that show, his father worked for Hammer Horror, so, and knew Christopher Lee, so we're going to get to talk about Christopher Lee.
Oh, fabulous. A hero, big hero of mine. And obviously, strangely enough, as you would, you know, obviously we were, before we started recording, we were talking about the Matthew Hopkins. And obviously, I know about Matthew Hopkins from the Hammer Horror film of Witchfinder General. Which is another one of my favorites, and one of my favorite actors, Vincent Price.
Old Vinny there, yeah. He's great.
Oh, absolute legend. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you in person. The very best of luck with the new podcast. If you've not listened to it, I recommend it highly enough. This first episode really gets the gets the premise set up for where you're going to go with it. And we wish you the very, very best of luck with it, Melissa.
All right. Thank you for having me on, everybody. And I really enjoyed coming on the show. It was great.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having us and best of luck. We'll speak soon. Take care.
All right. Cheers.